Lecture 34, Athenian Law and Society.
Ladies and gentlemen, hello again. We discussed aspects of Athenian society in the last lecture, and law is intimately part of that society. Since law is one of our course's major themes, and it's in the 4th century that the legal system reaches maturity, we're going to discuss law in some detail in this and in the next 4 lectures. But in this lecture, I'll comment on the differences between the classical legal system and that of today, and then I want to look at the relationship of Athenian law to society and vice versa. And I want to do this with reference to 3 literary works: Aristophanes' Wasps, Plato's Crito, and Sophocles' Antigone. I believe these 3 works show us in different ways and over a period of time how the Athenians were thinking about the development of their legal system, what their responsibilities were to it, and what they thought they could expect from the laws. Of course, there are more than 3 works from ancient Greece that we could discuss here, but we don't have the time within the confines of our course to do this. And since the 3 that I've mentioned are from a variety of genres as well, comedy, tragedy, and a philosophical treatise, I think they're as representative of the source material as we'll get, and that they show us how the Athenians viewed their legal system. It's an understatement to say that the Athenian judicial system was different from that of today. For one thing, there was no separate class of professional lawyers or public prosecutors. Both prosecution and defense were drawn from ordinary citizens who would have to bring a case themselves and to speak on behalf of themselves in the courts before a jury of their peers. There was no cross-examination during a case, and while the testimony of witnesses was admissible, it was commonly written out, at least after around 380 BC, written out before the trial and then read out in court, thus relieving the ordinary citizen of the pressure of cross-examination at least. There was no single judge in control of things, a judge who might interpret points of law and guide the jury. So the jurors were both judge and jury. They interpreted the laws themselves. They even decided the penalty as well, because for many crimes, a defendant found guilty could propose an alternative penalty. The jurors do not seem to have been worried about precedent in any way, and as there was nothing like a higher court of appeal as there is today, once the jury had made its decision, that decision was final. Now, every year, a panel of 6,000 Athenian male citizens over the age of 30 was selected for jury service. The jurors were known as dicasts, and they swore an oath to uphold the laws, an oath which I'll quote in a few minutes. They turned up on the days when the courts were in session, and this was every day of the year, apart from days when a festival was being held, or when an assembly was meeting, or days of ill omen. A complicated selection procedure was followed to reduce the possibility of bribery, as the men, the jurors, were randomly assigned courts to hear cases. They had no idea in advance what cases would come before them. Now, in another lecture, I'll take you through the system from initiating a case to the court appearance and the method the jurors used to vote. And in doing so, I'll expand on some of the points I'm making in this lecture. Another major difference between then and now was the speed of trials. The Athenian constitution tells us that 4 private speeches and 1 public case were judged per day. So that means that the whole procedure was probably very rushed. The vote for or against the defendant was part of the trial day, and if a defendant was found guilty, his punishment was applied immediately. This included executions, which were carried out the next day. So there was nothing like death row in Athens. We've got no idea, by the way, where the jail was located in Athens, or whether it was just one building or a series of buildings. Some sources seem to indicate that the jail was in the general area of the Agora, as passers-by could see some of the prisoners. On the other hand, if you go to Athens today and you walk down a wooded track a few minutes from the Pnyx area, the Pnyx is where the assembly meets, then you'll come across a cave in front of which is a sign that claims this was the place where Socrates was imprisoned in 399 before his execution. We just don't know where the prison is then. So anyone who says he or she knows where the jail was in Athens is about as credible as someone who claims to have seen Elvis in Des Moines or somewhere like that. Depending on the type of case, the jury was often composed of hundreds and in some cases thousands of citizens. Think about the trial of the Arginusae generals, for example, in 406, where the entire assembly heard the case. Several thousand there. In the case of private suits, those that involved a sum of less than 1,000 drachmas had a jury of 201. Those suits over 1,000 drachmas had 401 jurors. In public suits, you could get juries of anything from 501 to 1,501. The odd number, of course, is to prevent a tied vote. The speaking time for each side, prosecution and defense, was equal. It was measured by a water clock. And this water clock was only stopped for quoting evidence, witness testimony, and things like that in private suits. The water clock was not stopped in public suits, which meant that you had to time things very carefully when it came to supporting evidence and the like. We've already talked about the segregation of women in society, and that carries over into the legal arena as well. Women were not allowed to appear in court, just as they couldn't attend the assembly. If a suit involves someone's wife, then the kyrios, that's the head of the oikos, remember, the husband in this case, or if it's the daughter, would be her father, the head of the oikos would appear on the woman's behalf. If it was a wife and her husband was deceased or couldn't represent her for some reason, perhaps he was overseas engaged in trade, then her nearest male relative would do the job. We've got a very famous prosecution speech of the late 330s BC that involves a lady called Neaera, who is the wife of a fairly prominent Athenian man called Stephanus. This is an instance, clearly, of an Athenian citizen marrying outside the citizenry because Neaera was not Athenian. But since she was Stephanus' second wife, that might well be the reason why the two of them got married. I'll come back to this case a couple of times in the next lectures, so I'd like to say a few introductory words about it now. Neaera was a former child prostitute from Corinth, who had children by other men, looks like three children or so. She was freed from her brothel, but ended up in some abusive relationships until rescued by Stephanus of Athens. He took her to Athens and eventually married her. In the present case, Apollodorus, another Athenian man, has charged Neaera with passing off her illegitimate children as legitimate Athenians. As we talked about last time, only legitimate Athenians could inherit the oikos, and only children born from both parents who were Athenians could be citizens as well. So what Neaera is doing is quite illegal. And Stephanus, her husband, is also incriminated in the charge because apparently he knew what was going on. Neaera was indicted under a procedure called graphe xenias, which was a public offence. It was a public procedure, just like adultery. Now, although the charge was made by Apollodorus against her, it was Stephanus, her husband, who delivered the defence speech. By the way, the charge is political. We've only got the prosecution speech from this trial. That's the speech by Apollodorus. And he makes it plain at the very beginning that he is the political enemy of Stephanus, that he has clashed with him a number of times politically, and that this is really what's going on when he brings this charge against Neaera. What's more, the events of the case happened decades ago. Neaera and Stephanus have been living together in Athens for probably 30 years, and no one's bothered them until now. So this is a very nice example of a case that's brought for purely political reasons. But it also gives us a vivid insight into what the Athenians thought about people trying to pass off illegitimate children as legitimate. By extension, it gives us an insight into the importance attached to the oikos and the polis because of the people's reaction to what Neaera allegedly did. Women were marginalized by the law then. As I said, Neaera was actually represented by her husband. She couldn't appear in court herself. Nonetheless, we've still come a long way from the days of pre-Solonian Athens, when the non-nobles, remember, had no political, social, or judicial rights, when justice was dispensed arbitrarily, and the ordinary people were at the mercy of the aristocratic families, both in their local areas and in Athens. Thanks to state pay now, the poor had the means to partake actively in political and judicial life, and they swore to uphold the laws in order to ensure stability in Athenian society and to ensure their own protection. Non-citizens, unsurprisingly, were not as well served by the laws. Metics, that's resident aliens, had some judicial rights, and it was the Polymarchus Archon that was the magistrate charged with overseeing their disputes. Bastards, or nothoi, had little judicial rights, and slaves none, as was the case with prostitutes. Now today, there's a conscious attempt to protect everyone under the laws, even people who have entered a country illegally. But that was not the case in classical Greece. Back to Athens, from where most of our information comes. The Athenians viewed isonomia, a term they coined which means equality before the laws. They viewed isonomia as fundamental to their society. And isonomia, equality before the laws, carried over into their political system as well, emphasizing the theoretical equality of everyone who lived in it. Like religion, law went hand in hand with Greek society. However, the Athenians had no such thing as the rights of individuals as we do today. Now, in our last lecture, we talked about the intimate relationship of the oikos to the polis, a far closer relationship than today, because the oikos is actually helping the polis maintain its standard of living and also its security in Greece. And since the oikos is the backbone of the polis, so to speak, we see that the Athenians developed their laws to protect it, to protect the oikos, and then the individuals who composed it, rather than the other way around, as we're used to today. The Athenian democracy is often called the rule of the law by some modern historians. That's because of the isonomia at the heart of the society, which by extension bound the individual and the state together in a form of social contract. That's something that we today can identify with. Without that contract, society would fall into anarchy, the very last thing that the Athenians, indeed that the Greeks as a whole, wanted. And we know this by now. We can see something of the Athenian attitude to their developing legal code and the relationship of law to society in a number of contemporary literary works. And I'd like to discuss the three I mentioned now at the start of my lecture. The idea of a social contract is found in its most explicit form in classical Athens in Plato's Crito. In 399 BC, Socrates was condemned by a court on trumped-up charges of corrupting the youth and impiety. Apparently, he disbelieved in the traditional gods and tried to introduce new ones. And he was selling all these wacky ideas in the minds of the youth. Socrates was therefore put on trial, he was found guilty, and he was condemned to death. That would have been the next day. His friend Crito visits Socrates in prison on the eve of his execution, and he tries to persuade Socrates to flee the prison because his trial was a sham. The charges were brought against him for personal and political reasons. In reply, Socrates says he's aware of all this. He knows what's been going on. But Socrates refuses to flee because he has sworn to live by the laws of Athens and the decision of the law courts. In other words, although Socrates has been wrongly condemned, in other words, although the jury wanted to get rid of him and so found him guilty, for Socrates to flee would mean dereliction of his duty and loyalty as a citizen. Because Socrates says that it's not the laws that are at fault, but the citizens who put them into practice. Nevertheless, he's been found guilty and now he has to suffer what the law lays down. The bottom line is that Athenian society, like any society that doesn't want to suffer anarchy, has to uphold the laws. The laws exist for the common good. Therefore, individuals are bound to obey them so that they and the city can expect to be protected by them. And so, Socrates must die. What's interesting, though, is that in 399 BC, Socrates agrees to die according to these man-made laws. Half a century or so before Socrates' trial, the Athenians were grappling with the difference between natural or divine law and man-made law. And we can see this in Sophocles' Antigone, which was performed in about 441 BC. Now, this was 4 years or so after the 30 years peace that ended the First Peloponnesian War, remember? The First Peloponnesian War of 460 to 445. Now, in the Antigone, the king, Creon, has ordered that the corpse of one of Antigone's brothers, Polynices, who he considers was a traitor, should not be buried, but should be left to rot, to be eaten by the birds. Creon has laid down a law, a decree, that if anyone does bury him, then that person will be executed. Antigone has also lost her other brother, but he was a hero, and so he's been buried in accordance with what society would expect. The play then is about the clash between natural or divine law and man-made law. It binds together two things that are at the heart of Greek society: religion and law. Natural law says bury the dead. Not to do so is to dishonor the gods and also to dishonor the deceased, because the souls of those who are not buried roam forever in Hades. However, man-made law, in this case the king's, Creon's, says not to bury the man, Polynices, in this instance. Antigone then is in a dilemma as to which law to obey. Finally, she buries her brother, she buries Polynices. And when her execution is ordered, she kills herself by blocking herself up in a cave. Creon hears what's happening. He realizes the error of his ways and he rushes to spare her. But he arrives too late and she's already dead. Now, plays at festivals whether they are tragedies or comedies, were written to win first prize. They would be evaluated by a panel of judges who would, of course, take into account how they appealed to the people. That means playwrights are not going to write something that the people will hate, or something that goes too far beyond what people at the time were thinking. Otherwise, the people won't like the play and it will never win first prize. It's clear then that as Athenian society was changing and advancing, the people as a whole were wondering not only about a citizen's duty to the state and what would be the best laws to protect the state, but they're also wondering about how to reconcile new laws with traditional ones. The Antigone captures all of that. Antigone follows natural law. But half a century later, Socrates follows man-made law. And perhaps the reason for this change in attitude is the intervening Peloponnesian War, which brought with it a falling away from the traditional orthodoxy. The people clearly appreciate how serious law was, and by extension, how it was the anchor of their society. That the well-being of Athens rests on its laws, as well as its oikoi, is found in forensic oratory, for example, all the time. But that doesn't mean the Athenians couldn't enjoy a joke or two at law's expense. In 422 BC, Aristophanes used the jury system as the plot for his satirical play, The Wasps. This was the year, 422, remember, that in the Peloponnesian War, Cleon would try to recapture Amphipolis, but he and Brasidas the Spartan would die in battle there. Now, in The Wasps, the chorus of wasps is the jurors. They are characterized as old, cynical men who are always keen to find defendants guilty, and they're greedy only for their daily pay. The daily pay is 3 obols, which was about half of what an unskilled laborer made in a day. Now, in The Wasps, the anti-hero is an elderly juror who suffers from jury mania. This is a made-up word. Aristophanes does this all the time. This elderly juror is not interested in the fairness of the case. He's only interested in being a juror so he can find the defendant guilty. He enjoys the entertainment value of the courts, of watching the defendant squirm when attacked by their prosecutors. His son, the hero, is determined to cure his father of this jury mania. And so he tries to keep his father prisoner at home, like putting him in rehab today. Eventually he succeeds. It's quite a battle, but he does succeed. But along the way, he has to combat his father's various escape attempts and even hold a mock trial of the family dog that is accused of stealing cheese. Now, this is a very funny play. You should read it. But is it funny because the picture Aristophanes paints of the jurors is wrong? So that's the laugh. Or is the picture right? And if it's the latter, are we privileged to get an insight into the court system that shows us it was essentially amateurish, despite how formalized the judicial system became? For a play to be successful, whether it's a comedy, satire, or tragedy, it has to have a kernel of truth to it. And the same's true of today. The skits, for example, that work best on shows like Saturday Night Live only work if they have a factual basis. I'd like to suggest, well, it's a bit of a heresy now, that while the courts did entertain, as we'll talk about in a future lecture, the image of the jurors in Wasps is not typical. And I'd further argue that our factual base is only the old men who comprise the jurors. And that's because this play was performed in the early stages of the Peloponnesian War. That meant that most of the younger men were away fighting. Remember, 422 and the Battle of Amphipolis. So that left only the older men behind in the city to serve as jurors that year. There's no reason to think that the nature of the jurors portrayed in The Wasps is typical, or that the jurors couldn't understand at least some of the points of law. Men of the 4th century were fairly knowledgeable about current and past events, many from attending the assembly or even serving in the boule. And those who served as jurors would also have attended assembly meetings at least. I think men of the 4th century were more knowledgeable about affairs than men of the 5th century. And then there's always the street talk that permeated Athens when that city faced any event of significant importance. Men also collected in the agora and in places like barber shops to discuss current events. They might not know all the ins and outs of them, but they had some idea of things as a result of all of this. Moreover, forensic speeches were often filled with political content, especially if the case involved a public matter. The courts were often as political an arena as the assembly. And those giving speeches in court were often as versed in rhetoric as speakers in the assembly. And they had to be, because just as in the assembly, speakers in court needed to put on a good performance to help their cases appeal to the jury. But speakers in court also paid due regard to law and to the juror's knowledge of it. Appeals, for example, might be rhetorical, as we'll discuss in a later lecture. But there was no place for rhetoric in what law entailed. In other words, what made up the law. The jurors also swore a lengthy dicastic oath, which is given to us in a speech by Demosthenes. And I'd like to quote now some of the relevant clauses from it. If any man tries to subvert the Athenian democracy or makes any speech or any proposal in contravention thereof, I will not comply. I will not allow private debts to be cancelled, nor lands nor houses belonging to Athenian citizens to be redistributed. I will not restore exiles or persons under sentence of death. I will not expel, nor suffer another to expel, persons here resident in contravention of the statutes and decrees of the Athenian people or of the council. And then it goes on. I will not take bribes in respect of my judicial action, nor shall any other man or woman accept bribes for me with my knowledge by any subterfuge or trick whatsoever. And then finally, I will give impartial hearing to prosecutor and defendant alike, and I will give my verdict strictly on the charge named in the prosecution. The jurors swear this oath by Zeus, Poseidon, and Demeter, and in doing so, the jurors invoke destruction upon themselves and their households if they transgress this oath. Now, given the importance of religion in Greek life and the fact that the oath is sworn in the names of the principal gods of the upper and lower worlds, this oath was not one made lightly. These gods could overrule Athens's patron deity Athena if they wanted to punish the city. That's if jurors sacrilegiously broke their oaths. Who served as a juror? Jury pay was not a fortune. Pericles had introduced it in the 450s at about 2 obols a day, and in the 420s it was raised by Cleon to 3 obols a day. As I said, this is the equivalent of half a drachma, or an unskilled labourer at this time made 1 drachma a day, so it's half the rate of pay. What's more, the daily payment stayed at the 3 obol level even as late as the end of the 4th century, although pay for attending the assembly as well as basic wages rose considerably. A normal Attic worker could make far more on a building project or in the fields at harvest time than a juror could. And I'll have a few words to say on the difference in pay in a later lecture. But a goodly number of jurors were probably those who could afford to take time off work, and the elderly who didn't work anymore. And they saw jury pay as a bit like an old age pension. So they didn't necessarily represent a broad cross-section of society like today. Nevertheless, jurors took their participation in the jury system seriously. And they understood that this rule of the law was the basis of Athenian society. In swearing to uphold the laws, they strove to ensure that their society lived by them, that the well-being of the polis was anchored in them, and thus that the polis did not suffer anarchy or oligarchy, the one form of government that the Athenians were most against. Think about the reaction of the men with the fleet at Samos in 411 during the rule of the 400 in Athens. And especially think about the reaction of the Athenians to the bloody oligarchy of the 30 in 404 to 403. In the next lecture, I want to give a historical survey of the development of the judicial system. This will involve some recap, but that's necessary, as I want to bring together various threads that we've been weaving about law's origins and early developments from previous lectures, some from quite some time ago. And then, with these fresh in our minds, we can then go on to see how law reaches its mature form and what are its characteristics. Thank you very much.